Ukraine's foreign minister says don't believe Russia's talk about its willingness to enter into peace negotiations.
They regularly say that they are ready for negotiations, which is not true, because everything they do on the battlefield proves the opposite.
Plus, we hear from one Russian in Ukraine fighting against his own country.
I'm not fighting against my motherland. I'm fighting against some zombies, and I'm fighting against Putin's regime.
And later in the program, how the desire to help Ukraine expressed by a 7-year-old American girl has prompted some critical support rolling to that country. Today is Tuesday, December 27th, 2022. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Herman. Cities in eastern and southern Ukraine were shelled and bombed by Russian forces on Tuesday. This is occurring a day after Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, gave Kyiv an ultimatum: accept Moscow's demands for ending the war or suffer defeat on the battlefield. The Russian demands include Ukraine recognizing Russia's conquest of 1/5 of its territory. Hard hit in the latest Russian assault in the Donbas region, the industrial city of Bakhmut, already mostly reduced to rubble and devoid of nearly all its residents. In his Monday night video message, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky termed the situation along the Donbas front line difficult and painful. Over the past day, according to the general staff of the armed forces in Kyiv, the Ukrainian military has repelled Russian attacks in the areas of 2 settlements in Luhansk province and 6 in Donetsk. There are also reports of more shelling by Russian forces in Kherson City in southern Ukraine, in the Zaporizhia region, and of settlements in Kharkiv in the northeast near the Russian border. Ukraine is effectively calling on member states of the United Nations to remove Russia as a permanent member of the UN Security Council and to exclude it totally from the UN. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine to discuss this is Miroslava Gangadze, VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief in Warsaw. Welcome again to the program.
Nice to be here today, Steve.
Miroslava, on what grounds does Kyiv claim that Russia's UN membership is not valid?
Basically, Ukrainian government is arguing that the Russian Federation took over the seat of the permanent member of the UN Security Council, bypassing the procedure defined by the UN Charter. I have to remind the listeners that Ukraine was one of the founding members of the United Nations. On June 26 of 1945, Ukraine signed the United Nations Charter when it was a part of the Soviet Union. The legal experts are pointing out that the current UN Charter does not contain the words Russian Federation. These words are also missing from the Article 23 of the UN Charter, which lists the permanent members of the UN Security Council. The legitimate procedure for the state called Russian Federation to become a member of the UN and take a seat among the permanent members of the UN Security Council was supposed to be done according to the UN Charter. Ukrainian officials are arguing that Russia became the permanent member on the basis of an ordinary letter from the president of the Russian Federation, Boris Yeltsin, addressed to UN Secretary General, which was sent on December 24th, 31 years ago. I have to add to the context that only day later, on December 25th, Ukraine was recognized by United States as an independent state.
They were recognized by the United States or United Nations?
By United States.
The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry on Monday put out a lengthy statement on this topic. Is this a new request from Kyiv?
In Kyiv and among legal experts, this question was raised many, many times. And me personally, I interviewed President Poroshenko in 2015, and he actually back then called for Russian to be removed from the as a permanent member from the Security Council. So this question is not new. What is new that Ukrainian government is actually taking a looks like legal actions and doing some formal request to the UN.
I see. Finally, how forcefully do you expect Ukraine to push this issue now at the UN? We really haven't seen anything like this occur since 1971, when UN representatives voted to throw out the Taipei China Nationalistic Party government from the China seat, handing it to the communists in Beijing. But that was very different circumstances than we're talking about here.
I actually had an interview with the U.S. ambassador to the UN recently. I asked her, is it possible actually to even discuss this issue? And she said she does not see the legal process for it, but she said it doesn't mean we should not try. So basically today, the war of the Russian Federation against Ukraine is a violation of the goals and principle of the UN Charter, and it's unprecedented since its signing in 1945. So Ukraine has a ground and a good timing to push this issue.
I know you'll be watching it from there, as well as our UN Bureau Chief, Margaret Bashir, at the United Nations in New York. We'll keep everyone posted on further developments. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA's Eastern European Bureau Chief in Warsaw, thank you.
Thank you.
Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba says his nation wants a summit to end the war, but he does not anticipate Russia taking part.
We are aiming at the end of February, when the war will kind of enter is expected to enter its second year. The idea of the peace formula is twofold. On the one hand, not to allow Russia to manipulate the issue of peace, because they regularly say that they are ready for negotiations, which is not true, because everything they do on the battlefield proves the opposite, proves the to the contrary. They're not seeking peace.
In an interview with the Associated Press, Kuleba was asked who would host such a meeting.
The United Nations could be the best venue for holding this summit, because this is not about making a favor to a certain country. This is really about bringing everyone on board.
Kuleba said that Russia must face a war crimes tribunal before his country directly talks with Moscow. He added, however, that other nations should feel free to engage with Moscow, as happened to negotiate a grain agreement between Turkey and Russia. Kuleba also said he was absolutely satisfied with the results of President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to Washington last week, and he revealed that the U.S. government has made a special plan to get the Patriot missile battery it is sending to Ukraine operational there in less than 6 months. Usually the training takes up to a year. Kuleba also said during the AP interview at the foreign ministry in Kyiv that Ukraine will do whatever it can to win the war in 2023. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. The St. George Monastery in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region is now riddled with bullet holes and pockmarked with shrapnel. Two Russian men in uniforms can be seen inspecting the rubble and debris. Unlike most of their compatriots, they are there to fight for, not against, Ukraine. They're part of the elusive Freedom of Russia Legion. They are hesitant to provide specifics about their numbers or structure, and most hide their identity to protect family members back home. Their spokesman, a 50-year-old, only identified by his radio call sign Caesar, in a rare interview denounces what he calls an unfair war.
I'm not fighting against my motherland. I'm fighting against some zombies, and I'm fighting against Putin's regime. Not against people, but against evil.
Russian state-affiliated media claim the Legion is more a public relations exercise than a true and significant fighting force. Russia's first deputy prime minister, Andrei Belousov, on Tuesday told state television that recovering consumer demand and returning profitability to the corporate sector are challenges to the government in Moscow to address next year. The Russian economy is set to contract for a second consecutive year in 2023. Western sanctions against Moscow in response to its invasion of Ukraine and a partial mobilization of mostly working-age men are contributing to longer-term economic issues such as falling disposable incomes. Belousov acknowledged in the TV interview that the economy is close to stagnation. He predicted a drop in inflation next year that could allow Russia's central bank to ease monetary policy. But international economists surveyed by the Reuters news agency has a consensus that inflation in Russia will run about 6% in 2023, which would make it difficult for the Bank of Russia to cut interest rates. In the 10 months since Russia invaded Ukraine, the Ukrainian economy has been dealt harsh blows. As we've reported repeatedly on this program, infrastructure has been destroyed, the electricity supply repeatedly disrupted and repaired, and millions of people have been displaced. Ukraine will be dependent on aid from the United States and other countries for many years to come. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine to discuss this is David Wessel. He is the director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. Welcome to the program, David.
Good to be with you.
I know it's a big list, but what do you see, David, as the most critical and immediate challenge to Ukraine's economy as a result of this war?
It's hard, of course, to overlook the fact that it's an ongoing war. Ukraine has lost a substantial amount of its territory. Millions of people have been displaced, some inside Ukraine and some outside Ukraine. And of course, as you mentioned, just incredible amount of infrastructure has been destroyed. That's the backdrop for discussing the economy, which of course is secondary to any military thing. The problem Ukraine has is that it's hard for an economy to function when it's under attack and its electricity is being constantly disrupted.
Right.
Although Ukraine has proved impressively resilient, like the trains still run, and they seem to be incredibly good at repairing electricity, the estimates are that the gross domestic product, the total value of all the goods and services produced in Ukraine, will fall somewhere between 30 and 50% this year. That's Great Depression kind of stuff. Unemployment, to the extent it can be measured, is about 35%. Since they don't have enough tax revenue or foreign aid to cover their bills, the central bank is printing a lot of money. So inflation is close to 30%. This is not sustainable. The Ukrainians hope, and so do their allies, that the countries of Europe and the United States and Australia and Japan will make good on their promises to support the economy of Ukraine for the duration of the war. But there have been actually more promises than actual checks sent.
Right.
And so they have a problem. And the problem is that it's hard to fight a war when you can't export because your ports are blocked and you can't raise taxes because people aren't actually working or making money.
Let's assume this war is over in a year or two, and that's an assumption, and Ukraine survives as an independent nation. How confident are you the government in Kyiv will be able to stand up on its own economically eventually? And what does that timeline look like? Or is that just all way too speculative to forecast right now?
I think it's a good question, Steve. Given how well the government of Ukraine has functioned under these incredibly adverse conditions, where ministers are negotiating with the International Monetary Fund from underground bunkers, and members of their family are either in exile or in hiding, I have a great deal of confidence that they will be able to function when peace finally comes. One of the things that distinguishes Ukraine from some other war-torn countries that the U.S. has helped rebuild is that they are apparently a functioning democracy with capable technocrats. With help from the West and with the planned integration of Ukraine into the European Union, when the war finally ends, they have a substantial chance of being a very successful economy.
At Brookings, you recently held an event titled Rebuilding Ukraine, Principles and Policies. And I know one of the things you discussed was learning lessons from past international efforts at reconstruction, including the Marshall Plan for post-World War II Europe, and the experiences in other places such as South Sudan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Inefficiency, waste, and corruption are always challenges. And we know before Russia invaded, corruption was a problem in Ukraine, and there was a lot of political infighting in Kiev. Are you worried about a return to this so-called business as usual in Kiev when billions and billions of dollars flow into Ukraine in what will certainly be a massive post-war rebuilding effort?
Of course. So, but a couple of things to keep in mind. One is there will be waste and corruption, particularly in construction. There always is. It's not unique to Ukraine. And to some extent, if we're going to rebuild their electricity grid and repair roads that have been bombed by the Russians and give people places to live, we have to accept that there's going to be some corruption, some waste. If we spend a lot of time getting a perfect process, people will die. So the near term, we're going to have to accept that. I do think it's important, though, that as we go forward, that there is a efficient mechanism for dispersing and monitoring the aid. If there is just widespread corruption, it'll make it hard for the West to sustain their support. But there are two things to keep in mind. One is people who know Ukraine better than I do say that they've actually made substantial progress in dealing with some of the problems of corruption and the lack of prosecution. In a sense, they're not getting credit in the public image for improvements they've made. And the second interesting thing, and I think this is, remains to be seen, is that the Ukrainian economy was held captive by a number of oligarchs who controlled major parts of the economy. The power of those oligarchs has been weakened, and they may be in much better shape to run an efficient economy. And finally, they have a huge incentive to clean up their act because they want to be part of the European Union. That is part of their economic strategy and, frankly, part of their security strategy. And the European Union has some serious standards that you have to meet to be a member of that club. And so that provides Ukraine with some substantial incentive to do this. I should say one more thing about their capacity to succeed in a 21st century economy.
David Wessel at Brookings, thank you for joining us today on Flashpoint Ukraine here on the Voice of America.
You're welcome.
This is Flashpoint Ukraine, coming to you from Washington on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Herman. Ukrainian soldiers have built a mobile surveillance tower on top of a car to help them to locate targets for artillery strikes. Fighters of the 127th Territorial Defense Brigade, together with volunteers, developed an 18-meter tower for adjusting artillery on a Soviet-era Gaz Volga. The soldiers set up the tower manually, which takes about 15 minutes. In the future, they plan to make this process automatic. Soldier Taras Shevchenko of the brigade says such a device did not exist in the Ukrainian army, so they drew some inspiration from more advanced surveillance devices in the United States.
We have not seen this. We only heard that in the U.S., in the state of Texas, and in the states that border on Mexico, this kind of thing is sometimes used. They rise 8 to 10 meters with the very precise equipment at the top, with echo sounders and other rather advanced devices that defend the U.S. border.
He says the tower cost about $5,000 to develop.
The first prototype is already working. The camera itself can see up to 5 kilometers, and the angle from 18 meters is high enough for accuracy, 2 to 3 kilometers distant. We see the target and can hit even a deep target location.
That is Taras Shevchenko, a soldier of Ukraine's 127th Territorial Defense Brigade. 7-year-old Lily Manson in the U.S. state of Illinois learned about Russia's war on Ukraine and decided she wanted to help. That desire has resulted in some critical assistance on wheels being sent to the country. Irina Matvichuk has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
In February, 7-year-old Lily Manson, who lives in the U.S. state of Illinois, learned that a war had started on the other side of the world.
I was watching the news with my dad, and on the news was the war. And my dad tried to, you know, turn the channel before I might see, you know, any of that. But I wanted to help.
For a few days, Lily wasn't quite herself, recalls her father, Chris Manson.
It bothered her enough that at one point, I remember we were having dinner one night, or going to sit down for dinner, and we were about to say the blessing before we ate. And, you know, she said, hey, can we pray for the people in Ukraine? Which kind of took me by surprise. It kind of caught me off guard. And then, you know, of course, yeah, sure, we can pray for them. That's great.
But thoughts and prayers aside, Lily asked her dad how they could help. He had an idea. He decided to find ambulances that could be sent to Ukraine. His next call was to an ambulance provider in town.
His only response was, the only thing he said was, what do you want, gas or diesel? And off it went to Europe and eventually into Ukraine.
Every ambulance Manson sends to Ukraine has all the necessary equipment, including cardiac monitors, defibrillators, and various types of traction devices to transport the wounded. On top of that, the ambulances can produce electricity while in motion. To attract funds and donors to his cause, Manson organizes events. Local politicians, businessmen, and authorities have even signed the cars that will travel across the world.
Signing the ambulance or the fire engine sends a message. When people see that in Ukraine, it lets them know that they're not alone.
So far, Manson has visited Ukraine and has managed to send 20 ambulances to the country. He hopes to send 20 more before the end of the year. On top of that, he says he now also sends fire trucks to Ukraine.
What is that?
That's a sunflower. It's actually the national state flower of Ukraine.
He says one day he'll bring Lily to a free and safe Ukraine. For Irina Matvichuk in Illinois, Anna Rice, VOA News.
It is common for tabloid newspapers, astrologers, and other self-proclaimed soothsayers in late December to make predictions about the coming year. Often their claims of clairvoyance are sensational and usually turn out to be wrong. The former Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, an arch-loyalist of Vladimir Putin, seems to be getting into that business just after he was given a new job this week as the deputy head of the Advisory Security Council to the current president. Medvedev has raised eyebrows in recent days with postings on social media making some wild predictions for 2023, including a war between Germany and France. He also says civil war in the United States will lead to billionaire Elon Musk becoming president. Musk, who now owns Twitter, responded on that social media platform, referring to the Russian officials' online forecasting as an epic thread. That's all for today's program. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for joining us. Until next time, I'm VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman. Good night.
Of America, Washington, ba 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 zip. deceived.